Actually, we have two speakers in Graham Richardson will do the second part of this talk. I will talk about these quantum definite theorems, and this is joint work with Matthias Kristandl and Reinhard Florenz. There's a long history of definite theorems for quantum states and also for other objects like classical probability distributions. I won't follow the course of this history and instead just jump right in. The only thing I would like to point out here is that, as you can see from this list, there are various motivations for studying definite-like theorems. I will try to give you the kind of motivation that is perhaps closest to the overall theme of this workshop. By the way, I would like to thank the organizers at this point for inviting me here. I'm really enjoying this workshop. Okay, so here's, the general situation we often encounter in physics, and actually many of the talks you've heard so far are exactly concerned with this situation. We have some exponentially large Hilbert space, but actually what we're interested in is only a very small subset of this Hilbert space. These might be the ground states of certain systems, and we might hope to get some kind of efficient contact description of such of this small subset of states. And well, just to give you the most simple example you can think of, I'm not a chemist, so I have to apologize in advance for certain things, I guess. But this is one simple example where we just have non-interacting fermions. So first we start with the original Hilbert space. We restrict to the fully anti-symmetric subspace. And then we specialize to the family of Hamiltonians that describe non-interacting fermions. So we just have a sum of single particle Hamiltonians. And as you know, for such a simple Hamiltonian, the ground state wave function is very simple. It's just a Slater determinant where these lowest energy levels are filled, basically. So we have a very simple description. And of course, things get slightly more complicated if you look at interacting fermions. So typically, we'll look at k-body interactions, two-body interactions, I guess, most relevant in physics. So the reason why I'm explaining this is because I really want to focus on the bosonic counterpart, basically. And that's an analogous situation, just that we start with the fully symmetric subspace. And in this case, the ground states of non-interacting systems will just be n-fold product states. So we just take the single particle ground state corresponding to a single particle Hamiltonian and take its nth power, and that will be the form of the ground state. So it's a very simple description compared to this exponentially large Hilbert space. It's just one state of one particle. And again, we might ask what happens if you turn on interactions, and this is kind of, one reason for studying definite theorems, I guess. So here's one basic thing that people do for interacting systems. Well, we can just use these non-interacting ground states as variational undot states for the interacting system. So of course, that's well known. So for bosons, we just take n-fold product states of a single state, and we call these the mean field undots. And for fermions, it just takes Slater determinants. And the reason is, of course, that we expect, at least if the interactions are weak, that these ground states of the interacting systems are somehow closed in some sense to the non-interacting ground states. So we have physically motivated undot states, and well, at least in some limiting cases, we know that these undot states are actually accurate in predicting, say, the ground state energies and so on. But then we might ask whether they actually tell us more about these interacting ground states, and perhaps we can even parameterize all or part of these spaces. So I will focus on this bosonic part. And well, let me just tell you a few things that we might be interested in. Of course, this the ground state energy that I mentioned. Well, for a k particle, for interactions that are k local, this will only depend on the k particle reduced density operator. I will explain that in more detail in a minute. But once you look at this expression, then you might think that instead of just approximating this scalar value, we might be interested in this whole reduced density operator. And that's actually useful for other reasons, because, for example, it gives you estimates on the entropy of that state, and that's useful in cryptography. And so Renato will talk about this tomorrow, I guess. So we might try to approximate these reduced entropy operators and so on. But this is what we're going to focus on. So let's go back to this problem of estimating the ground state energy of a bosonic system. So just imagine some simple Hamiltonian, which say has nearest neighbor interactions on some lattice, and these are bosons, so we know that this wave function has to be from the symmetric subspace. Now if you write out this this term, the overlap of the state with the Hamiltonian, what we get is basically the overlap of the reduced two-particle density operator with some two-particle Hamiltonian. And, well, here, well, in general, I will look at any number k of particles in the reduced density operator, but, of course, the most interesting case for chemistry will probably be the two-particle reduced density operator, because this determines the energy in that case. And so, of course, we've seen many examples of this before in the fermionic case. Let me just once again give you the definition. In the case of, well, in the case of the bosonic case, we can define a notion of so-called N exchangeability. So we say that a state sigma on, say, two systems or K systems is N exchangeable if it is the partial trace of a pure symmetric state on N systems. So here we usually have a large number N of particles, and we're interested in the K particle reduced density operator. And if this density operator here arises at the marginal of such a symmetric state, then we say the state is N exchangeable. Yes?
What is the difference?
So this is the exact counterpart, the bosonic counterpart of N exchangeability. The difference is that, well, for fermions, we want this to be in the antisymmetric subspace. Exactly. For bosonic systems. So that's what we're looking at. And that's kind of the harder version of the N representativity problem, because we demand that this state is pure.
Well, that's,
yes.
That's
yes.
Very special.
Yes. Later on, I will give you a different definition which doesn't demand that. But for the moment, I would like to focus on partial traces of pure symmetric states. Thanks. So that's an important point to stress. So, let's go back to this mean field ansatz. Well, what we're doing there is we're just taking an n-fold product state to kind of get an upper bound on this ground state energy. And if we plug that in, we get an inequality like this. And this might suggest somehow that these product states are in some sense an approximation of, well, of the set of n-exchangeable states. Well, that's not exactly true, and, but we will see that these product states play an important role, and this is really what definite theorems are about. Okay, so let's consider a few examples of symmetric states and their partial traces. So these are the n-exchangeable states. I guess it should be called sigma, but it doesn't matter. So the simplest example is if we start with a n-fold product state. So of course that's in the symmetric subspace. And if you trace out n minus k system, we end up with a K-system reduced density operator, which corresponds to a pure state in that case, and that's obviously a product state. So it's a pure product state as before, but here, as in the mean field ansatz, but here, if you start with a symmetric state, which consists of all zeros and all ones, then after tracing out, you end up with something that's not just a product state, but it's a convex combination of two-fold product states or k-fold product states. So this shows that we cannot just approximate by pure product states, but we have to take convex combinations probably. And then finally, here's another example that's the symmetrized version of 1, 0, 0, 0. So if you trace this out, you see that, well, we have some entangled part, but the rest is kind of a product state. And as n grows large, that goes towards the product state. So it seems that if n is much larger than k, then we should be able to approximate. And that's kind of the quantitative, well, that's kind of a restatement of the fact that mean field theory becomes exact if the coordination number goes to infinity. So, and definiteness theorems are about making this statement precise. So here's a schematic view of the set of n-exchangeable states. So we have these n particles, and we're interested in states of k particles. And because we take pure states here, the set will have a pretty complicated shape. It won't be convex, for example. So now, as I said, we have this subset of product states, and these are n-exchangeable because we can just take the n-fold product of this state and we get a symmetric extension. And what we're going to do is we're going to take the convex hull of the set of states of this form. So this is the set of states we're going to use, and that's what basically Frankfurt talked about. We're going to start approximating from the interior of the set. Well, actually, that's not quite true, because we might have states here that are outside this set of n-exchangeable states, but that's because we use this condition. So later on, that will go away. So now we're interested in the distance of the set of n-exchangeable states to the set of convex combinations of product states. And this is what we would like to quantify. Yes.
It seems to me the non-convexity can only come from the hole in the middle, not from
Yes. Well,
no, no, we take it up. It's true that every extreme point is pure, but it's not true that every pure case generates an extreme point.
That's correct. But my statement was that if you took the convex hull of all the pure states, okay, you get the mixed state exchangeable ones, and therefore what's missing should be a hole in the middle that would correspond to mixed state exchangeable rather than the outside.
That might be true. I haven't really thought about this picture, so I mean it's only schematic, but you might probably right. I mean, later on we will go to mixed states, and then the pictures are actually more beautiful. But, okay, so the definiteness theorem basically says that we can bound this distance, and in other words, we can approximate any n-exchangeable state by such a convex combination with an error that's given by this expression. So k and n are the number of systems, and d is the local dimension. So now I've gone to finite dimensional systems. And of course, once you have this kind of statement, you might ask how good this is. And one thing we know is that, well, certain states have this kind of distance to this green set. And well, I will discuss this in more detail later on, and Graham will explain where this kind of bound comes from, the D over N. But basically, well, now I would like to explain how we can obtain this kind of statement, that we can approximate any exchangeable state by a convex combination of product states. So the formal statement is the following. So we take a symmetric state, we trace out n minus k systems, we end up with this k system reduced density operator, and then there is a probability distribution on the set of pure states of one system, such that if you take the convex combination of k-fold product states with this distribution, then this kind of expression approximates this state with this error. Of course, this distribution depends on the initial state. Yes?
So you would think that this is also bosons, but this is not a boson.
Well, it's not strictly boson anymore, because I'm looking at finite dimensional. So the statement holds as it's stated. Yep. It's the Yes. But that's kind of the motivation, and there's several reasons for. Okay, maybe that was misleading. So. Okay, and then the converse statement is of this form. So we can find any changeable state, which are partial traces, but they cannot be approximated by any convex combination. Okay, so to give you kind of an idea of how you get this kind of result, I will first explain what this subspace is, and this is probably well known, but so here we're looking at the n-fold tensor product of this space C to the D, and there's a simultaneous action of the unitary group and the symmetric group on this space. So these actions commute, and that means we can find the decomposition into irreducibles of this form. So here the unitary group acts on this first space, and the symmetric group acts on this space, and we know that the labels of these representations are Young diagrams, which correspond for the unitary group to the so-called highest weight. So that's just a way of identifying representations for SU2. It corresponds to the total angular momentum. So we get this kind of decomposition here, two examples, but really what we're interested in is just this symmetric diagram. So now, but Graham will talk about these other spaces too. So for the symmetric diagram, this representation of the symmetric group is one-dimensional. It's a trivial representation. So every vector is just fixed by the permutations. But the unitary part is more interesting, and that's what's called the highest the representation with highest weight n. And well, this is just I won't go into any details, but it's just basically telling you what the action of the subgroup of diagonal matrices is on a certain basis. So you can find a basis of so-called weight vectors, and this is given here, and you can define an ordering on the eigenvalues of this action, and then you can define what's called a highest weight and so on. But the important thing I would like to point out is first that there's a basis of this subspace that is of this form, and this n-fold tensor product of a single vector, which we're finally going to use to approximate, actually has a very specific role in that representation. It's the so-called highest weight vector.
Here, when you say highest weight, you're using weight in the sense of total
spin
in a certain direction.
Yes. I mean, it's just the algebraic weight. Okay, so the proof of the definite theorem is now really simple. It's really just an application of Schur's lemma. So what does Schur's lemma say? Well, if you have an operator that commutes with the representation, then that operator has to be proportional to the identity. And the way to get an operator that commutes with the representation is you just average over the group action and act from both sides. So you take any operator, and you take this kind of integral with the Haar measure here, and what you get is something that's proportional to the identity. So that's the first step. And we apply this to the operator, which is just a projection onto the highest weight vector. And that gives this kind of decomposition. So we can say the identity on the symmetric subspace is a scalar times an integral, or basically a sum, of n-fold product states. And this this factor here is just the dimension of the representation. So now I will not actually give you the proof, but just to give you some intuition about why this is useful, here's kind of a fake proof. What we do is we take this symmetric state, we write its projection here, and we put identities in front and behind the vector. So, and then we just plug in this expression, and what you get is basically some coefficients times this operator, which is just ket phi bra chi to the nth power. And the reason why this is useful is that we can now kind of trace out. So we're interested in the partial trace. This is in an exchangeable state. But if you trace out n minus k systems of such an operator, what you get is the overlap between phi and chi raised to the n minus k power. And now you see that if n is much larger than k, then this will basically be zero unless these vectors are equal. And here you kind of see that you end up with product states. So that's not really a proof, but it can be made rigorous. And okay, so the actual proof uses another Schur's lemma twice, not just once. And well, it uses the identity on the symmetric substrate on n minus k subsystems in the same fashion. And the reason why this identity is important is that, well, these vectors aren't just fixed by the identity on the whole space, but also by the identity on all subsystems, on all the k first subsystems, and the identity on the symmetric subspace of the second n minus k subsystems. And, well, this is basically the only time that, well, something about representation theory comes in. And what comes in is that this symmetric representation is contained in the tensor product representation of these two. And, well, once I've given this, it shouldn't surprise you that, well, the approximation error will be some function of these dimensions. And that can be upper bounded by d times k over n. So these are the basic ingredients. So now I've explained how, well, where this upper bound comes from. And as I said, there are lower bounds of this form, square root d over n and k over n. And these basically tell you that this kind of approximation is necessarily limited. So for example, if you look at infinite dimensional systems, actual bosons, say, then we cannot expect to be able to approximate by such convex combinations of product states. And also, if k over n is not small, so if n is comparable to k, then we don't get an approximation like this. And therefore, at this point, you have to think about how you can generalize this result and perhaps still get an approximation. And basically, there are two things you can do. So one thing you can do is you can make this green set larger to decrease the distance, or you can make the red set smaller. So the first one corresponds to taking a larger set of approximating states. So we allow something that's not of this product form. And there are various theorems that go in this direction. And the other thing will be to take a smaller subset of an exchangeable state. So we restrict to a subset of states and for which we can still prove definite theorems. And finally, you can also just forget about exchangeability and look at more general symmetry. So there are various results that I won't explain. The only thing I would like to explain is this exponential definite theorem by Renato Renner. And okay, so to explain that, it's useful to go back to this proof or to the setting. So we have some state in the symmetric representation which is contained in the tensor product representation of these two. And what we did is we fixed one particular vector in the first space. And this basically defined our approximating state. So it was the highest weight vector, and the approximating states were convex combinations of rotated versions of this vector. And what we obtained was that the error is kind of bounded by the dimensions of these representations. Of course, once it's written down like this, you can immediately generalize this. And in general, you're just looking at triples of representations. And instead of taking just a single vector, we can actually take a whole subspace and approximate by vectors which lie in kind of rotated versions of this subspace. And what you get is kind of a certain measure of overlap of this particular subspace just by applying Schur's lemma to slightly different objects. And so many theorems fall into this class. So you just take you can take different groups and different representations, and the exponential definite theorem is actually a special case of this. So again, I won't explain this list. Okay, so let's try to come up with a better approximation to an exchangeable state. And as I said, in the original definite theorem, we just use n-fold product states. So, and the reason, well, the physical reason is maybe that, well, these correspond to ground states of non-interacting systems. And so this motivated this mean field ansatz. But of course, to improve this mean field ansatz, what you could do is you could include excitations of such non-interacting systems. And now it turns out, of course, the excitations are just the highest weight states. So these are states of this form. And if you take the span of these states, what you get is basically symmetrized versions of states that are product on, say, n minus r systems and are non-product otherwise, or we don't know about this part. So here we just fix r to limit the accuracy of the approximation. So we just say r tells us how many of these positions may be non-zero. Yes? Yes. So here there will be a whole list, but we omit the ones that are. Yes. And this cutoff is one way to cut it off is say you take a number r, and anything that has less than r zeros will be thrown away. So we only, in terms of the Hamiltonian pictures, we only take the highest or the lowest energies. Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I guess. Are you talking about the whole representation, or? So I'm just talking about n particles. I'm not talking about tensor products at this point. But. Yes, it's kind of a right. Expansion around the mean field.
Right. So we call that CI in chemistry. And one thing is just one of the things in chemistry that CI is not expensive. When you go to the bigger form, maybe Mary can talk about.
Yes. So R has to scale.
Yeah, I mean, one of the ways of thinking of the weight, and this here, you're just looking at the half part, is the weight. So you fix a direction in which you're going to quantize the spin, okay? And the weight is the total spin in that color, the z direction. So the, you know, the highest weight states would have spin n over 2, and this would be n over 2 minus a half and n over 2 minus 1. So you might think of them as states that have high, not high total spin, but high spin in a certain direction. And you're making them completely symmetric. It's not, at this point, a very realistic, but if you wanted, for example, these would, normally you would take a sum, but for example, if you looked at the dual of that highest weight symmetry, then you could multiply it by something that has a corresponding anti-symmetry, or pseudo symmetry or anti-symmetry to get something from total fermionic state. But I think the main thing is here is to remember that high weight is essentially the spin in when spin is quantized in a certain direction.
Okay, well, maybe I'll take expression for
later. Okay. Okay, so now we'd like to get a theorem that uses these kinds of states, as ansatz states. And so in the previous theorem, we just used these highest weight vectors or the subspace, and now we're going to use, states of the form that I've just given you. They're product, they're all zero on from now k minus r systems and can be different otherwise. And then we can basically use the same proof to get an approximation in terms of rotated versions of such vectors. And now the error scaling is much better. So here's a particular example. So we can take constant k over m. So in the normal definitive theorem, this would just mean that the approximation error is equal to this constant. So it's not very good. But then we can allow some small non-product part. And by small, I mean square root of k is much smaller than k. But you can come up with more extreme examples. But the main point is that the scaling of this approximation error then goes like constant to the minus n. And I guess Renato will use this theorem in his talk or a version of this. Okay, so the last thing I would like to mention is that, well, so far I've been talking about partial traces of pure symmetric states. But there's a different notion of symmetry. Of course, we can say that the mixed state is symmetric if it commutes with these permutations. And if you start with this notion, then we get a slightly different notion of exchangeability. So here we say that a k-party density operator is unexchangeable if it's a partial trace of a symmetric mixed state that has this property. So of course this property implies that for the projection onto psi, but the opposite direction is not true. And this kind of symmetry is more natural in, well, say spin systems. So suppose you have n spins and they interact with each other with the same interaction. Then you have this kind of Hamiltonian symmetry, and you can shift this over to the state, and you get a symmetric state that has the same energy. So this is more like what Frank talked about when he talked about permutation invariance. There you just had the translation invariance. So there you had translations instead of permutations. And it's also this notion of symmetry is also more closely related to the classical definitive theorem, but I don't really have to go into this. So once you have these two notions, you can ask, well, what's the relation between the two? And there is actually a map that goes from states of this form to states of that form, and that's very specific to symmetry. I don't think I have time to explain how you construct this map, but in essence, you have to double this local dimension to go in this direction, and then you trace out in that direction. And by using this map, you can translate definitive theorems for exchangeable states according to this notion to definitive theorems for exchangeable states that are partial traces of mixed states. And well, if you do this kind of translation, you have to go from b to b squared, and similarly translate these dimensions. And the other difference that's important is that while you're approximating by pure product states here, convex combinations of pure product states, because you take the partial trace, here the approximation will be by a convex combination of mixed states. Okay, and Graham will talk about exchangeable states of this form. And I will hand over to him.
Very good. I too would like to say how much I'm enjoying this meeting and to thank the organizers for inviting me. And I'd like to register a complaint, which is that the caliber of talks has been so very high that I haven't been able to relax the whole period. And it's extremely stressful to keep one's concentration going for this length of time, but also very enjoyable. And so I should say that appearances notwithstanding, I am really the junior partner in this. When I came along and got interested in Definetti theorems, Renato and Robert had been working on it for a long time, and Matthias was also getting up steam in his inimitable way, and that was also a most enjoyable collaboration. I'm going to talk about a very small piece of the story, and not being a physicist, it's well suited to me, and also not being a mathematician, it doesn't involve too much real mathematics. What I'm going to tell you about is, as Robert was saying, it's a case where we're looking at mixed states, and these states have a very nice symmetry, which greatly simplifies a lot of the calculations, and it actually enables one to produce some very beautiful examples and to produce some bounds, which Robert was alluding to earlier, which are rather hard to obtain otherwise. So I wonder how readable this is.
Can you use the Zoom feature?
Just try and do that. Let's see. Is that better? Okay. So, I see. And is this the pointer? How do you switch this thing on? These are particles. That's the extent of my grasp of physics. And you have n particles here, and that they have permutation invariants. But the new thing we're adding is unitary invariants. So under the action of the unitary group on each term simultaneously, and these states on such a system were studied by Werner, and in honor of him, call them Werner states. So these are symmetric Werner states on the n-fold tensor product of a d-dimensional space. And Robert mentioned the Schurweil decomposition, and I've just worked out. Maybe I'll slightly decrease it. There we are. So here's an example showing what happens when you have. Oh, thank you. That's a very good idea. Brilliant, brilliant. So here n is 4, and so we have a system of dimension 16. And in this case, there are three diagrams that come into play. We don't have to consider diagrams of any greater depth because the dimension is 2, so we can't actually have a diagram, let's say, with a depth of 3. And what we find is that this 16-dimensional space breaks up into three subspaces, and if we look at the dimensions of the representations, that's the unitary part of it, and that's the symmetric group part of it. We can calculate the dimensions of those, and I've written those underneath. And when we add up the dimensions of these three pieces, we find, of course, that they add up to the total dimension of 16. And they're embedded in a very subtle way into the 16-dimensional space. And so let's call P lambda the projector onto the lambda piece, and rho lambda is the normalized projector. And thanks to Schur's lemma, what we find is that any symmetric Werner state can actually be written as a convex sum of these normalized projectors. So that actually gives us a very, very simple picture of what these symmetric Werner states are. They're just a polytope with the extreme states being these normalized projectors onto these subspaces. So that's a very promising start, and the states are very easy to describe. And now, how about the approximating states? So instead of, well, what we do is we take an arbitrary state and we can twirl it, which means that we integrate over the unitary group the action of the so K is the number of copies of C D and the action of G. And so if that were a Werner state, then of course by definition the twirl would just be the same, we get back the same state. But now we look at a particular kind of state, which is a twirled product state. So we take any state on CD, we take its k-fold tensor product, and now we twirl it, and that I'll use the letters TP to mean twirled product state. And these are actually the states that can be used that will give us our Definetti theorem. And if we have any Werner state, then the best approximation, the best Definetti approximation, can be taken to be by twirled product states, and there will be other product states, but in fact, by simply twirling them, we discover that the closest state can be assumed to be in the set of twirled product states. So that's what we want to focus our attention on. Now I'm going to use a bit of notation, which if we're given a diagram lambda, then lambda bar will be the normalized row lengths. It'll be so these will sum to one. They will be positive. And supposing we're given a state sigma that has a spectrum lambda bar. It's just not the way any spectrum, any rational spectrum, could be written that way. But actually, this theorem holds for any spectrum whatsoever. But it's just going to be convenient to look at those that are derived from a diagram. Then the twirled product state can be written in this form. So it's a sum of these normalized projectors with particular weightings, and these weightings consist of the dimension of the symmetric part of the representation for the label mu, and then a Schur function evaluated on lambda bar. So there are two things to explain there. One is why we get this formula, and the other is what a Schur function is for people who are not familiar with that. And so to do the first one first, if we ask what the coefficient of rho mu is, then we can just get that by taking the trace of the projector at mu onto this state sigma. I've left out the lambda bar. And now that, in fact, is the character of the representation we get by projecting onto that subspace and acting with the group element sigma tensor sigma, so now that's an element. So we're looking at the unitary representation, but this, of course, will be a Hermitian matrix. But we simply apply the machinery to interpret that as an element of GLK. So we have the character of that representation and times the multiplicity, which is this dimension of the symmetric group. That's where that comes from. And to explain what Schur functions are, so supposing we have an irreducible representation of UD, so that will send an element G belonging to UD to some matrix, and then we define the Schur function, which is a character at G, by the trace of that representation at G, and that will just be the sum of the eigenvalues of G. So to give you an example of that, if we take the symmetric representation mu, then we can assume that G is diagonal because we can introduce diagonalizing matrices into here, which then by cyclicity of the trace we can cancel. So we can always assume that we can always take the diagonal form of an element to calculate the character. And if we apply it, let's say, to the element 111, then we apply G individually to each one of these terms, and that's, if E1 is the eigenvalue corresponding to 1, then we get E1 cubed, and for this element of the representation, we get E1 squared times E2, and so what we're interested in is the sum of these terms, and the Schur function will just be, these are a couple of examples, and in general for a d-dimensional space we can write it as EI cubed plus EI squared EJ over all IJ, and then EI EJ EK. And so you basically can calculate Schur functions by this operation of looking at all the possible weights that you get in the representation. So that harks back to what Robert was saying earlier. And just to look once more at this formula, it's very nice that we can describe the approximating elements in this very exact way. And in fact, we can ask, what do these weights look like? And they're actually peaked around lambda, or lambda bar, and that is due to a very nice theorem called the Kalvenner theorem, which quite possibly Matthias will talk about when he talks later in the week. So having got the class of approximating states, the next thing we can do is actually to ask what the trace looks like. And rather amazingly, there is an explicit formula for the trace of a... So we only have to look at our extremal states, and then any other state is a sum of these, and so we can work out what the trace is from that. And so if we look at a particular rho lambda in n dimensions for n particles, then we have this formula. And the thing which is novel about this is a thing called the shifted Schur function, which was defined by Kunkhoff and Olshansky in a very nice paper. I will explain, it's not possible to give a completely transparent explanation of how this formula comes about, but best I can do is to kind of approach it from two ends and hope that you will be satisfied. The first thing to say is that the shifted Schur function is like a Schur function plus some extra terms, and so its highest degree part is the Schur function. It's homogeneous to degree k, which is what a Schur function is, and then it has some extra lower degree terms. And so here's an example. Here's a shifted Schur function for lambda, and it consists of the ordinary Schur function minus, which is quadratic, minus some linear terms, and that's what it looks like over there. So now, to explain why the trace should have that strange form, let's imagine that the trace, well, we know that it must be expressible as, since it's a Werner state, as a weighted sum of these normalized projectors, and these coefficients in fact have this form. And so what is this expression here? Well, we can rewrite it as the trace of the tensor product of the identity on the n minus k positions that we're tracing out times p lambda. And now we can break up the identity into a sum of projectors over all the Schur-Weil decomposition subspaces. And now we've got something really quite familiar, because this can be calculated from the Clebsch-Gordan expansion, which gives us a sum. So these are the multiplicities of the subspaces that appear in this tensor product. And what that means is that now our trace formula has got this factor in it, which is the bit that we, before Kunkhoff and Olshansky came along, didn't know how to calculate. But they proved this very nice formula here. And the reason for being interested in the left-hand side here is that this is the dimension of a skew tableau of lambda with mu subtracted from it, with mu cut out of it. And that is actually a little piece of sort of representation theory calculational technology which was missing until you can calculate the in the case where you don't remove mu, you can use something called the hook length formula to calculate the dimension of lambda for the symmetric group representation. But this is a calculation for the skew tableau, and so that's the interest in this formula. And I can't give you an intuition for why this looks the way it does. They give an elementary proof, but it's not particularly transparent. And just to explain how you calculate these shifted Schur functions, you can calculate Schur functions by writing numbers. So here's an example for a little diagram with three boxes. Numbers that decrease. So often the semi-standard tableau is usually written with numbers that increase non-strictly to the right, but increase strictly downwards. And one could reverse that convention and say that they decrease non-strictly to the right and decrease strictly downwards. And then it's quite easy to see that if you look at all the possible tableau with numbers corresponding to the basis elements, you will get the Schur function. But now with a shifted Schur function, you do the shifting operation, and what you do is you take the column position and you subtract the row position. So it's the first row and column 0, so you count from 0, and you get -1 there and +1 there, and so now you subtract those numbers from each of the corresponding terms, and that gives you the first order term which pops up in the shifted Schur function. Okay, so enough on that, and back to De Finetti, because we're now all set to state the theorem. So here's the trace, and you've just seen that formula, and here is the formula for a twirl product state, and of course these are very close, and when k is small, there are k, it's about n to the k, and what you're doing is you're normalizing lambda, since this is a homogeneous polynomial. The homogeneous part of that is a degree k, and then the lesser degree terms all become small, and so you get a good approximation for k small and n large. And here's the beautiful formula. So this is the De Finetti theorem for Werner states, and instead of an unknown series of, or you know, an integral over all sorts of possible states, here we know exactly what we're looking at. We're looking at the twirled product state, which has spectrum lambda bar. And it doesn't matter what that state is, of course. The only thing that matters is the spectrum. And so we see a nice relationship between the spectrum of the state that we get and the Young diagram we began with. And that is a very convenient sort of calculational object. And the error can be shown to be of the order k squared over the smallest lambda, so that's the smallest length in the diagram. And so for scale diagrams, for example, that will be the order of k squared over n. So this is a satisfying result. So now I can actually show you, with luck, what happens. So here's an explanation on this side of what you're going to see on the right-hand side. So what we're looking at is D equals 5, so it's a five-dimensional space, and we've got it's raised and we're looking at n particles, and we're tracing out all but four of them. So now we come down to a space which is which has these as its extreme states. So these stand for normalized projectors. And what we're going to do to look into this space is to project onto this two-dimensional subspace here. So that's what's happened on this diagram here. Okay, I'm wrong about that. It should have been that state. Okay, but it really doesn't matter. And what you see here are the actual twirl product states. And of course, what we get when we look at some convex collection of states will be the convex hull of this. But it's nice to have the actual product states on display. And now what we do is we take, I think in the first case, n is going to be 10. So now what these are, okay, again, there's been a change of notation. Instead of these, so here I said the x's, but I mean these objects here, in fact, correspond to all diagrams with 10 boxes and a depth at most 5. So as you see, they're quite a long way from this region here, which is what we hope a Definetti approximation will end up being close to. And so we increase n to 19, and now you can see that they're beginning, of course there are lots more diagrams now because we've got diagrams with 19 boxes, but it's still not a wonderful approximation. But now we got 30, and these striations correspond to top rows of given length, I believe, and they're beginning to converge towards this region here. And now we have 50, and I think you can see that they're actually beginning to follow the scallops of this space, so of this region. And I'm not sure, do we get another one? Yes, we do. Yes, very nice. Okay, we're getting, I'm not sure, is there one more? No, it's just a sort of summary diagram. But that's, it's very impressive that now you can essentially look at the approximation of all Werner states for 60 particles. The reason you have a convex set here is, of course, because you're looking at all the states which are convex sums of all these different extremal points. Okay, so I'll leave that up and move quickly, I haven't got very much time, onto the question of bounds, which is another nice aspect of this technology. So supposing n were d, the dimension of the space, then we could look at the alternating state, which is the antisymmetric diagram, and if we trace out all but two particles, we end up, in fact, with something which lies completely in the antisymmetric space. So it's over here. And now we can actually calculate this region here in exactly the same way as it was calculated there using Schur functions. So the twirl product states are just given by weighted sums of these two diagrams, and we know what these Schur functions are. And it turns out that the point, the boundary of the twirl product states is a half 1 minus 1 over d. And so in this case, we actually are at a distance in terms of the trace distance of more than a half from the twirl product state. So this is a very bad approximation, but on the other hand, n is not arbitrary. We're looking at d particles at most, and we can get a bound for n particles by essentially repeating the same construction. We have a whole series of columns, and what we do is we trace out n minus k of them, and we now ask how far we are from the 12 product set. That would be a nasty calculation, but if we project down onto two dimensions, because the trace distance decreases as you trace out, then any bound we get here will also apply here, and now we can just calculate that, and what we get is that the trace distance for this particular diagram is actually equal to this expression, and so you can think of that as d over n. So it says that in the case of quantum definitely theorems, we actually have a lower bound of d over n, and this applies to all states. It's not just a special property of Wiener states. Having demonstrated there are states for which that's true, then that is the lower bound for all possible states. And this is quite striking because the dimension appears here, the dimension of the state space, whereas for the classical definitive theorem, if we have a small enough k, then it doesn't matter what the alphabet size is, you can get a good definitive approximation. So this is actually a rather striking result. Should I? 2 minutes. 2 minutes. Okay, in 2 minutes, I'll just very briefly say that you can do something. You can sort of generalize the class of things from so here we're looking at the at symmetric states, and we trace out a number of particles, but we can actually look at composite particles and trace out subparticles or subsystems, and if we do that, we end up with a theorem which is a kind of dual theorem. So I've just written this horrible formula here, I apologize for it, but it's to bring home the fact that the standard Definetti trace for Wiener states, so in the case of Wiener states, we can do all these calculations, that's the reason I'm looking at them, and we get everything here applied to the symmetric group, and this is a unitary group, this is the, but the we swap the symmetric group and the unitary group in the case of this tracing out of subsystems, and so we get a completely different kind of Definetti theorem. It's actually not a terribly interesting theorem in itself, because unfortunately what it says, instead of giving us an interesting class of approximating states like the standard Definetti theorem, it just tells us that we end up with the identity, so that it says if you in the standard theorem you get this beautiful approximation by product states. With the dual theorem, you end up with an approximation by the identity, which has various sort of informational. I would like to be the first person to use Alice and Bob. So I think what you can do with the aid of the theorem is you can do secret sharing. Alice and Bob share a state, and then Alice goes away with half of each particle, and Bob goes away with the other half, and they then have mixed states from which nothing can be infer, but when they come back together, then they can share and their secret. So that, as far as I know, is the only real use, at least that I can think of, for this theorem. But the idea that there are other types of Definetti theorem, I think, is sort of intriguing, and I have tried this out on various people, and it's probably nonsense because I've got no basis at all for it. But I would like to ask, is there a fermionic Definetti theorem? So if we're given a fermionic state, we trace out n minus k systems, then most certainly we don't have a product state. We've just seen that, in fact, that it gives us an optimally bad approximation. But can we write it as a convex sum of things which are single Slater determinants up to some approximation? So we were told this morning about the fact that there are systems which you most certainly can't describe in this way, but if you trace out from a high-dimensional system to a low-dimensional system, is that true? I've no idea for supposing it's true, but it's just one of many generalizations of Definetti theorems, which I think it would be fun to think about. Thank you very much.